It's the Big Dumb Picture Show. And welcome back to Big Dumb Picture Show. As always, I am your host, Dustin Meadows. Today we are skeleton crewing the podcast, and I am joined by only, but somehow still enough because he's delightful, Pat Deering.
Hey, Dustin, how are you?
Oh, I'm great. How are you, friend?
Excellent, excellent.
Good. We just watched the 1999, I don't want to call it smash or hit classic because I don't think it's either of those things, but 1999 kind of neo-noir crime film Payback starring Mel Gibson.
Yeah.
I remember seeing this movie in the theaters when it came out when I was in high school. And it being just a very, like, it seems weird that this movie got made. I was reading up on it, and it's an adaptation of a novel called The Hunter by Richard Stark. And this movie was originally made into a film called Point Blank, directed by John Borman, who probably most notably is the director of the film Deliverance, which is one of my favorite films from that era, and starred Lee Marvin, who also very iconic, badass kind of character. So I would be curious to see that version of the film and how it stacks against it. Just looking at reviews, that one fared a lot better than this. But it's weird because, like, I'm... Sometimes I am a Mel Gibson apologist. Because, man, he's been in a lot of stuff that I really love, but I also, fuck, man, he's a piece of shit.
Yeah, he's, like, a total lunatic.
Which is a huge bummer, because, like, you know, things like The Lethal Weapon, films, Mad Max, Bird on a Wire. I don't know why I said Bird on a Wire. That's not one of his bigger films. It's just one that I remembered with him and Goldie Hawn. But Mel Gibson is definitely, like, he's a very prolific figure, who, like, love him or hate him, he's usually a good, like, a solid actor. Like, he's in the films he's in. And he kind of got to a point where, like, he was channeling, like, that rugged, like, on edge thing, and it worked for him. And to me, this movie seems like it tried to capitalize on the Mel Gibson traits that it should have done 5 years sooner.
Yeah.
Because, like, I feel like if this movie had been made, like, early 90s, like, there would have been enough of whatever they wanted out of Mel Gibson that it would have worked better. But this one, like, not so much. Like, and there are even parts in this where it still works. Like, that voiceover, like, like, Jesus, how did nobody in the 80s make a movie with, like, Mel Gibson playing, like, a grizzled detective, like, doing all this, like, pulp narration? I did not expect to have as many opinions rewatching this movie as I did, but I'm getting ahead of myself. We'll get into this. So,
yeah.
So this movie was made. It was a very troubled production because the original product, the director's cut that was released later, is drastically different than the movie we just saw. They did 10 days of reshoots. They added the voiceover stuff in.
It's never good when you add a voiceover.
No.
It's never, never good. Poor Blade Runner.
Yeah, right? And that, oh, man. The first time I saw Blade Runner was the theatrical cut. And I actually remember at first when somebody told me, it was like, yeah, there's, like, a director's cut that doesn't have the voiceover. And so I was like, what? How could they? And then I was like, oh, this is actually good, because that voiceover narration was bad and out of place in Blade Runner. They also, Kris Kristofferson was not in the original film that was shot.
You know, like, I don't know anything about this movie, honestly. The first time I've seen it, I didn't do any research on it, but that doesn't surprise me. It seems like when he showed up, the movie just took a total slapstick turn.
Yeah, it's very, very different. So we'll get into that here shortly. This was a movie that came out in 1999 with Mel Gibson. How have you not seen this before, Pat?
I don't even know if I can come up with an excuse, given that I didn't even know this movie existed.
I mean, that's a pretty reasonable excuse.
I've seen movies like it from around that same time period. Nothing was really going on in the movie that, you know, I would have been banned from seeing it at 13 years of age or whatever. But, I just had no idea it existed.
Well, it's also, like, it's funny because I was thinking, because I recently, last month, we did the Time Machine 1999 show, where we looked at, like, all the pop culture of 1999, and we tackled, like, a lot of the movies around then, and 1999 is the year that gave us Wild Wild West, American Beauty, which, of course, like, swept the Oscars that year. It was, like, all over the place. Of course, most notably, Star Wars Episode One: The Phantom Menace.
Right, right.
The second Austin Powers was that year. Like, there were all these much bigger films. So it's no surprise to me whatsoever that this was lost in the shuffle.
Yeah, even though it did okay at the box office.
Yeah.
Though, right? I mean,
like, yeah, I don't think it lost money, but it was funny. Like, I was looking at one of, I think it was the Ebert review, and pretty much the only thing that really carries this movie is Mel Gibson's performance.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's absolutely accurate. And that was still, like, 1999 was still a time where we didn't know what a fucking nut job he was.
Right.
Like, we hadn't figured out that he was a lunatic. He hadn't gone full Passion of the Christ. He might have. If it was, like, at high school, I was not woke AF, so, you know, I didn't know about those things, you know?
Yeah, I think he had better luck hiding his blatant anti-Semitism, like, before cell phones and, like, instant recordability became a thing.
Yeah. So it's, like, it's no surprise that this movie didn't do better. It just, it's still, like, kind of bizarre to me that it exists. Because there was a string of, like, movies, like, in the back end of the 90s, because, like, Gibson was in this, and then he was in, like, Ransom or A Conspiracy Theory. Like, he took just a very sharp turn in, like, kind of the caliber and the quality of films he was doing, like, post Lethal Weapon 3. Because this would have been, like, I think this was a year or two before then he was doing, like, What Women Want and shit like that.
Oh, yeah.
I think The Patriot might have been in the mix somewhere around then. Like, it just, that whole timeline becomes, like, it's just weird, like, some of the projects he's in. It's like, because I feel like his career post Lethal Weapon has been largely directors trying to channel, like, what he does with the character of Martin Riggs into other things. Like, hey, what if Martin Riggs fought in the Revolutionary War? Here's The Patriot. Like, hey, what if Martin Riggs was, you know, relatively well off financially and his son got kidnapped and turns out it was Gary Sinise the whole time? Sorry if you haven't seen Ransom yet. Whoops. So, like, it's... God, yeah, this movie... It's bizarre that it exists. And it's even weirder because I apparently, like, remembered it so fondly that I bought it on DVD 3 years ago. But I bought the director's cut. It's called Payback, Straight Up, the director's cut.
Oh, dear.
And it is drastically different than what we saw. Oh, man. Oh, God. He's in Father's Day? All right.
Who? Oh, Gibson?
Mel Gibson.
In Father's Day?
Yeah. So, holy shit. So, this was after Lethal Weapon 4. So, this was after a return to form, even, for him. I didn't realize that this was after Lethal Weapon 4 came out. Because Lethal Weapon 4, not great, but it was at least kind of a return to what had helped blow him up so much.
Right. Back when the world still loved Mel.
Back then. Oh. Simpler days.
This post-9/11
Mel Gibson. We need our Mel Gibson pre-9/11. Thank you. So getting back to that. So this director's cut is a very different film. Mm-hmm. You know, like we mentioned, like the Kris Kristofferson stuff did not exist in the original version of this film. The character, in fact, only existed in a voice role. Like the phone call still takes place between him when he has Carter in the office, the first big dude that he kills. But from there, it's a very different film. And they excise the kidnapping subplot with the son as well. Like none of that's in there. And there's actually like a confrontation on the L in Chicago, which like they never say Chicago, but like this is very clearly shot in Chicago.
Right. Because the elevated line is right there in numerous shots.
So, and the final confrontation is actually, if I remember correctly, it's with John Glover, who plays the hitman that goes to blow up his apartment earlier and is like sitting in the back of the car reading the paper.
Uh-huh.
So like for the theatrical cut, that character was trimmed down massively. But in the director's cut, John Glover has a lot more scenes. And he's the one that Mel Gibson ends up like going against, and the movie ends like on a very ambiguous note. Like it doesn't have that phoned in Blade Runner theatrical cut where it's like them driving off and then the voiceover is like, maybe everything will be okay. Like, it's, if I remember correctly, it basically ends with him getting, like injured, like shot again, and you don't know if he makes it.
I'll have to check that out sometime, because that sounds the first, you know, three quarters of this movie I was really into.
Oh yeah, yeah. It shits the bed in the final act.
Yeah, it absolutely does. It gets slapstick. Almost. Yeah. There's that one point in time where Mel Gibson, you know, is in the back of the cab and he kind of turns the tables on like fake John Lovitz or whoever that person is, and then just as you know he's about to deal with that, Lucy Liu and the
band full of triads
show up, machine gun everybody. Gibson rolls out, rolls under their van, somehow shoots all of them, has a little confrontation with Lucy Liu, and then like blammo, large man comes up behind him and smacks him in the head with a nightstick. Like,
yeah, it all happens very quickly. And you're absolutely right. Like the first chunk of this movie is great. Like it's a lot of fun. Especially Craig Henry is really good in this. The guy who plays Val Resnick.
Yeah.
He is really good at being just a gigantic piece of shit. He's almost always either like a piece of shit or he's comic relief. Typically like in James Gunn films, cuz like in Slither he plays the mayor and he's fucking hilarious in that
right.
movie. And then of course he's now also in the Marvel Cinematic Universe as a Star-Lord's grandfather in both Guardians of the Galaxy films. He's in those movies for 2 minutes because James Gunn directed those as well. So James Gunn uses a lot of the same folks.
I will say that the first couple minutes of the movie I was a little confused because you know, his name's Val. And he did have, like, Val Kilmer's 90s hair in the role. So I kept thinking, like, wait, that's not Val Kilmer. But, it's like, not. It might be. Greg Henry. But, yeah, no, he was excellent.
Yeah, he's solid in this. That was the other thing I remember, too. The beginning of this film is very different. And I think they reshot the intro for the film to give us what we ended up seeing, where it's like that voiceover and Mel Gibson like laying on the table, getting bullets ripped out of him by an underground drunk alcoholic doctor and all that shit. And yeah, we might just have to watch the director's cut later down the road for the podcast. Cause now I'm curious to see it again, having freshly seen this. Cause this is the first time I have seen the theatrical cut since it was in theaters.
Yeah,
I watched this movie again probably 4 or 5 years ago when I bought the director's cut, and I remember getting through it. I was like, oh, this is less a director's cut and almost an entirely different movie. So now with this being fresher in my mind, now I really want to watch the director's cut at some point and compare.
Yeah, I'm really interested in that too.
Yeah.
You know, just because again, this movie goes from, you know, like hard boiled and re-hard boiled to nonsensical.
Oh yeah,
so
it's,
fast.
It's all across the fucking board. And I was reading too, like they did all this reshoots. Like the studios wanted to make it more mainstream. And I was like, you like this? This isn't mainstream though. Like this just it doesn't work.
No, it doesn't at all. I mean, was it just that they didn't want the ambiguity? They just wanted
they didn't
everything
want the ambiguity,
okay.
And they thought it was too dark. I was like, you greenlit a fucking crime slash noir film. Like,
right.
Noir literally means black, dark. Like, that's what these movies are. Like, they're supposed to, you know, they're supposed to be kind of a moral ambiguity. The good guy does not always win. And this one, the good guy is not even a good guy. He's a fucking professional thief.
Right.
It's like, there's not a single, like, good person in this movie. Because, like, the closest thing that you maybe have is Kris Kristofferson's son, Johnny, who is still a person who knowingly benefits from the criminal lifestyle afforded by his father's, like, criminal organization.
Right.
So, and even the cops are fucking crooked cops.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, and I love that, I do like that Mel Gibson has that line, like, corrupt cops or there any other kind, and especially now, oh boy, no,
yeah,
no,
no.
Rings real true.
Yep. Yeah, and you know, you can see that throughout the first parts of the movie where, you know, Gibson is just, he's just a fuck, he's just a terrible person.
Oh yeah.
But then, you know, towards the end, you know, he's helping out this call girl that he used to know, and they're going to Canada, and she's gonna stop hooking, and he's gonna stop killing people, and
yeah, it's completely against character. Like, yeah. None of it makes sense. So yeah, we're gonna do the director's cut sometime, because now my mind is racing, like, because I know there's a lot of other stuff I'm forgetting too, because God, this movie is so fucking different from the way it was originally intended.
Mm-hmm.
And that's always interesting to see too, because like I like looking into movies and seeing like what the differences are. Like I own plenty of movies. I've got like the unrated cut or the director's cut. And there's all these ridiculous things that like change, like something like say First Blood with Stallone. Like that movie originally was supposed to end with Rambo getting killed and then just done.
Huh.
And then somebody was like, well, that's too dark. And then now it's become like this huge action franchise,
right?
Which is not what the first film is about at all. So it's interesting seeing like kind of how studio interference and creative control, like shifting around, like affects that, because that film had ended that way. Like we'd have First Blood. We would not have Rambo 2 or 3, or specifically Rambo First Blood Part 2, I think it was called when it originally came out.
First Blood Part 2.
Which was like, you don't get First Blood Part 2. You're just Rambo 2 now. And you look at other stuff too, like case support with Blade Runner.
Yeah.
Another one that I have, all 4 Alien movies. And every single one, there is a director's cut in addition to the theatrical cut. And most of the times, like, the director's cut usually means the movie is longer. Which sometimes is like, no, maybe we're okay with this movie being 2 hours instead of 2.5
right.
hours.
Looking at you, Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, oh, man.
How many more fucking orcs can we kill?
Yeah, I still have not watched the extended cuts. Gateway's doing the entire trilogy this fall, so
yeah.
I'm probably going to go see the extended trilogy finally.
Oh, they're doing the extended ones?
I think it's the extended ones. I know they're showing them on 35, so
yeah.
I could be wrong. It might just be the theatrical cuts, but either way, I own the extended cuts, which I have not watched yet because how do you mentally prepare yourself for that?
You don't. You just have to let it happen.
I love movies, and the thought of watching anything longer than about 2.5 hours fucking terrifies
me. Yeah.
Like I had to watch Seven Samurai in parts because I could not commit more than 3 hours to a movie.
Mm-hmm.
And movies are like my favorite thing in the world.
Speaking of times, Payback, what time period is this movie supposed to be in? Why are they all wearing 90s clothing, but like using rotary phones and driving around in cars from the 70s?
It's really bizarre because like it kind of has like that thing with Batman the Animated Series where it kind of looks like it has modern sensibilities, but it also looks like maybe it's in the 40s or something.
Yeah.
So, it's very bizarre.
Or, you know, like Archer, where they're always doing the whole, like, well, the Soviet Union still exists, but there's cell phones?
Yeah. So I kind of like that it keeps you guessing, because it seems like, for the most part, like, it could very well be, like, in the 60s or 70s. There's not a whole lot that I feel like gives it away as being a more modern film. So even, like, when they're running a credit card, like, they're still using, like, that old-timey, like, slide thing where, like, they physically, like the card to run it. And I was like, Jesus Christ, I haven't seen one of those since I was, like, 8 years old.
Right. But then at the restaurant, you know, it's getting declined automatically.
Yeah. So it's all over the fucking place. What's going like, on? It's inconsistent. So, yeah, God.
Yeah. And, you know, if you're trying to make a movie, you know, set it in a certain time period or just even leave it ambiguous, you know, I think a stumbling block you can run into is that you just might inadvertently just make the whole thing look dated.
Yeah.
Because, you know, the cinematography and then all that stuff doesn't look like a 1999 film.
No, it absolutely doesn't.
If you hadn't told me beforehand, I would have guessed, you know, like 85, 86 or something.
Yeah, that's fair. Well, and this movie has a very deliberate look to it as well.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's very, very cold looking.
Oh yeah, the palette is all steel and gray and charcoal.
And they even like with the costumes and the buildings and the cars they use, like they deliberately went with colors that would like just lend themselves more to that.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a very clear vision for this film, and the way it's shot with the way the theatrical version ends, like, doesn't make sense.
Right.
And it's a bummer, too, because, like, I actually really like Kris Kristofferson in this movie. And it sucks that wasn't part of the original, like, vision for the film. Because he's great. Like, he is a solid, like, he's intimidating. Like, God, what is it? He says to him, he's got that line, "Tell me where my son is. You want to find out what your left ball tastes like."
Yeah.
And he's just like this terrifying person.
Mm-hmm.
And James Coburn is just this like high strung, like criminal boss.
Yeah. Pissed off. He's getting bullets shot through his suitcase.
To his alligator suitcase. That's just mean.
Yeah. I mean, excellent character there. What was, Kris Kristofferson's character,
James Coburn's.
Yeah, what was the name they gave his
Fairfax.
Character? Fairfax.
Yeah,
great Carter name for Fairfax. A big bad too.
Yeah, old Fairfax. I kept thinking of Carfax Abbey from Dracula every time they said his name. But yeah, I'm excited to watch the director's cut of this at some point and kind of have comparison because I remembered liking the director's cut more, with the exception of not having Kris Kristofferson in it. Because I do think he's really good. I think he, especially because Greg Henry's character checks out like halfway through the movie, like it can't fall squarely to one character to carry the entire film.
Right.
So like I think like having a Kris Kristofferson in the film earlier could have been beneficial, or even John Glover, who's a fucking phenomenal character actor, who is so underutilized in this cut of the film.
Oh yeah, he's there solely to get exploded in a car.
Yeah, he has two scenes and maybe four lines.
Yeah,
and I love John Glover, like he's great. One of my favorite things will still always be him in Gremlins 2 as the the executive of the building that the Gremlins locked down.
Yeah.
He's amazing in that. He's actually the only part of Batman and Robin that I like because he plays Dr. Woodrue, the scientist that tries to kill Poison Ivy and turns her into Poison Ivy.
Right.
And he is so good in that role. Like, he fucking commits And he's also about the only good part of the show, Smallville, was him and Michael Rosenbaum, who played Lionel and Lex Luthor, respectively.
Okay.
Because everything else about that show is fucking trash. Because, I mean, it's a CW show anyway, so that's not... There's
what,
not
are you, what are you going to get?
You're not going to get too much, but like John Glover is a really solid character actor, so I always love seeing him pop up and stuff. And to go into this and realize that he was in this less than the director's cut of the film that I saw more recently, like that was disheartening because he's so good.
Yeah, I mean, I can't even speak to it because he's in this theatrical cut for maybe 5 minutes.
Yeah,
they really do kind of build him up in Carter's office.
Yeah,
make him look real scary, like he's really going to go out there and be a real thorn in Gibson's side. And then
the next time you see him, he's reading a paper in the back seat, and then he gets blown up.
Right after Mel Gibson somehow like comes out the building. Like unseen. Army crawls on his stomach across traffic, underneath the car, cuts the gas line, crawls away without any of these mooks realizing that he's doing it.
Yeah, which, and so I think too, like without the son kidnapping angle, without Christofferson, like I don't think there's that scene where he leads anyone to that apartment to blow him up. So I think that him blowing the car up, I think that might be completely excised from the director's cut.
Yeah.
So it's, yeah, there's just a lot of misfires in this movie, which, and it sucks too, because this film is full of fucking character actors.
Yeah.
Like, so this movie should be, this version of the film should be much better than it is, but it's not because of like studio interference. And I think I was reading the after when they went to do the reshoots, they brought in the production designer to take over directing the rest of the film instead of Helgeland, who wrote and directed everything. And that's fucking nuts to me, too, because this dude wrote L.A. Confidential.
Right. Which didn't it get like a Golden Globe or something like that year?
Oh, it got L.A. Confidential was 97 or 98.
Okay.
But that's still like, if you came to me and said, hey, this person was largely responsible and had a hand in L.A. Confidential, which is one of the best neo-noir films of all time, like one of the best films of all time, too. It's an amazing film. Like, I would give them fucking like carte blanche to do whatever they wanted.
Right.
Because like Curtis Hanson, who directed L.A. Confidential, he went on. Next thing he did was 8 Mile, which is a completely different fucking thing. But I mean, for like all criticisms anyone might have of Eminem aside, like 8 Mile is still a good movie because Curtis Hanson did it.
Right.
And I think there's a good movie that got buried in the theatrical cut here from the dude who wrote L.A. Confidential.
Yep.
So I guess the big takeaway is fuck studios. Like just fuck them up their stupid ass. Like it, like there are definitely times where I think studio interference is absolutely helpful. Cause it, you know, you look at other movies like at original endings that may have been shot. Like 28 Days Later, I think they had like two or three different endings in mind for that, and one of them like originally involved Cillian Murphy's character like getting a complete blood transfusion to save Brendan Gleeson's character who gets infected, and then like before they even started shooting it, it was like that's stupid, like that that's impractical. Whether that was the studio's call or him realizing it, was like sometimes like your original vision doesn't make sense. And right. And it's one thing to like catch like logical invalidations of what you wanted to do with it, but in this case like they thought it was too dark, and as a result of that tampering we have a movie that starts off promising, follows through on a lot of what we want to see, and then completely turns the corner and is a different kind of movie by the last 30 minutes.
Yeah absolutely. And I don't know, I really don't understand why the conclusion was reached that it was too dark or too aggressive or anything like that, because the first three quarters of the movie, again, are pretty dark. Mel Gibson's horrible, his wife dies, steals from a bunch of people.
Mm-hmm.
Even the homeless guy is horrible. Even the homeless guy is lying about being disabled.
Yeah, lying about not being able to walk.
So I really don't understand how the conclusion could have been reached that, you know, a dark ending would have been inappropriate for any of these characters.
Well, it's one of the frustrating things. Like, I'm rereading a screenwriting book called How Not to Write a Screenplay, which is like my favorite text on it.
Mm-hmm.
And they talk a little bit about like the notes process that executives go through, and like these people don't know how to make a fucking movie,
right?
Like, so they don't understand why something doesn't work, and I've listened to like comedians like who do punch up for scripts, and other people that have written, and like people will give notes just to give notes, even if there's no note to give anything on. Which is the dumbest, like, it's this whole, like, corporate idea of, like, oh, well, nobody can be perfect. There's always some, like, basically the takeaway is they're always going to find something wrong, which is a stupid fucking way to look at anything, especially right. Artistically.
Well, everyone's got to prove their worth.
Yeah, and it's like, why don't you just say, it's like, oh, no, this movie is great. Good job, P.T. Anderson.
Yeah.
Like, because I'm trying to imagine, like, if something like There Will Be Blood had to go through shit like this, like, but it wouldn't.
Right.
Because, it's very clear, like, just by having P.T. Anderson attached to it alone, like, you already know the kind of film it's going to be. By having Daniel Day-Lewis attached to it, you already know the kind of film it's going to be.
Absolutely.
And nobody is like, oh, we don't think it makes any sense that Daniel Day-Lewis wears a hat in one scene and then doesn't wear a hat in the next scene. Or
you either get rid of the hat or you commit to the hat.
Yeah, but like that's the kind of stupid shit that they say.
Right.
Like stuff that has nothing to do with the story, stuff that has nothing to do with like the character, just things that invalidate the tone, that make it inconsistent, and it's fucking frustrating and it's mind-boggling. And like, especially like even as when I was taking film classes in college, and I was doing like classes where we would write scripts and we would peer review each other's scripts, which is the worst thing in the fucking world. It's why I don't do writing workshops. It's why I don't fucking ballpark jokes to anyone.
Mm-hmm.
Like art by committee is fucking stupid. I think ultimately it hinders the process. It hobbles creativity, and like, and I some people, sure, maybe like there's a benefit to it, but for me it just seems like a way for people who don't understand what my idea is to try and inject my stupid idea with their stupid ideas.
Right. They're just trying to get it to where they want it to be.
Precisely.
Not necessarily improving what it is you're trying to do.
Yeah,
and that's almost exactly what happened here. It's almost like the studio was worried that there were too many loose ends and that they had to tie all of them up, otherwise the film wouldn't work. So we get scenes like, you know, where they eliminate, you know, all these different side characters that had nothing to do with anything.
Oh, yeah.
For no reason. No, I didn't care what was going to happen to this Chinese gang.
Yeah.
I didn't care what was going to happen to... Sledger, Schrodinger,
oh, the fucking cops.
Oh yeah, them too. No, I mean the little
Stegman.
Yeah. All these names. I can't remember the guy's name. Why do I care what happens to him? They didn't. You know, they didn't need to wrap up the storyline for every single character.
Yeah, but that's exactly what, like there are no loose ends by the end of the movie. I was like, there can be loose ends. Like right. There, you don't need to put a bow, especially a movie like this. Like, you know, a fucking noir, like a darker film, like. It almost honestly kind of makes sense if we get to the movie and there are some loose ends.
Oh, absolutely.
Like case in point, the final cut of fucking Blade Runner ends with Deckard leaving and Ruben Blades' character, the other cop, like,
yeah,
hinting very much that he's probably going to have to go after him. Like, and that's fine. So.
Right. I mean, it would almost have improved things if, you know, they left the crooked cops, like, still working because that's, you know, a little bit more realistic.
Oh, yeah.
And definitely lends itself more to this world that they've created. If that Chinese gang still went about, you know, whatever their money laundering scheme was that they had. You know, no matter what it is that Mel Gibson does, no matter how many members of the syndicate he gets rid of, it keeps going because that's just the nature of organized crime.
Yeah, it's constant as the tide. Oh, cool. I think I think I have exhausted my opinions on this version of the film at this point. Because I really want to see the director's cut.
I do
now
too
for
now.
This, so.
Yeah.
So I guess let's do favorite moment, favorite scene.
Favorite, honestly, that first bedroom scene with Val and Lucy Liu's character. When they first introduce her, Pearl's her character's name. A hilarious just little side character that has almost nothing to do with anything. Really lends itself though to the image of like just borderline lunacy that they want for this Val guy. It really lends itself to just making him as much of a sadist as they can without him actually having to do anything to the main character or anything like that. So I thought that was a deft like maneuver that was both kind of slapstick, kind of comic relief, but also at the same time, like really lent itself to how scary this guy can be.
Yeah. So now do you mean when she first shows up or when Porter shows up later and then she starts beating the shit out of him for him?
That's also a great scene, but when she first shows
up. When she first shows up
and he just,
you know, hits her with the phone.
Yeah, just unabashedly beats her while still being like nervous about what's going on with his business.
Yeah.
Like he's totally capable of inflicting pain on a human being while being more concerned about his money. So.
Yeah, no, that's a good one. I think for me, probably, God, just it's like there are moments and there are characters that I like. I think it's hard for me. I think if I was going to go with one, it would be any point where Mel Gibson, like, just straight up in cold blood fucking executes someone. Because I think when the first, when he shoots, I think, no, I'm going to go with when he kills Resnick. When he kills Val in Rose's apartment.
Oh,
I like that
yeah.
scene. It's like he just kicks in the door, like, fucking takes him off his feet, walks by, like, not. Like just in continuing with his character, and I thought that was more consistent that scene still at that point, because he kind of like eyeballs her like to see if he's okay, doesn't ask, just like forgot my cigarettes,
right?
Like that's what he says, and then he kills Val after he tells him he doesn't have a light.
Yeah, then what good are you?
Yeah, and then he just point blank in the face, like so, because I think that is most consistent with that character. And scenes like that make Mel Gibson's character work in this movie, but then, like we said, that kind of starts to crack more, like the deeper the movie gets into the third act.
Right. With things like, you know, it was kind of funny the first two times that they like, all right, all this for $130,000. He was like, actually, it's 70. And by like the sixth time he's done it, I'm like, we get it.
Yeah,
we get it. It's not
ridiculous.
About the money. It's about the principle.
Yeah. What I like too, I almost wish it had come back again, because twice in the movie, Mel Gibson threatens someone for information, and the person's like, do you know what they'll do to me? And like he just like slaps him. He's like, what do you think I'm gonna do? Worry about me.
Yeah.
Like that should have been the character throughout.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like we see it start to wear away after he kills Val in the apartment. To the point where, like, by the end of the movie, we're not even dealing with the same version of that character that we had for the first hour.
Yeah.
Speed segment. Payback 2. What happens after Payback 1?
Payback 2. Pay harder.
Yeah. Payback with a vengeance.
God. Well, I mean, yeah, the studio already eliminated everybody.
Yeah.
I think the only person they left alive and in the States was Lucy Liu.
Oh, and Johnny.
Oh, and Johnny.
Bronson's son.
The kid.
He probably wants revenge. I bet that plays in somehow.
Yeah, yeah.
5 years later, when he finally chews through his own wrist to get free of the handcuffs that he's handcuffed to a radiator by.
Oh, God, I forgot. They just left that kid to starve to death in this apartment that obviously no one checks on.
Yep.
Oy vey. Yeah, I mean,
where's your neat little bow now, studio?
Yeah, so I'd assume that that Lucy Liu and Johnny team up in some fashion.
Oh yeah.
And they create some kind of cross border new age crime syndicate, less city mafioso and more, I don't know, some kind of Rush Hour nonsense.
The Franco-Chicago Alliance.
Yeah.
I was just trying to think, in keeping with my love of John Glover, he somehow survived the car explosion. Ooh. And is now horribly disfigured as a result of it. Maybe like a Crossbones in Captain America kind of situation.
Yeah.
Where he's just burned and like doesn't feel pain anymore. And he's got some ridiculous suit.
Mm-hmm. Mel Gibson does a lot of punching him in the next one. He doesn't even feel it.
Yep. Mel Gibson
rolls his eyes.
So then Mel Gibson hits harder with just some anti-Semitic slurs, and that's what really cuts him to the core. There's one thing John Glover hates, it's racism.
Yeah. Mel Gibson, who's now just like limping around because he had every bone in one of his feet shattered.
Oh my God,
with a hammer.
Yeah. Which that also that torture scene, obviously not in the director's cut.
Yeah.
Because man, ooh, that was uncomfortable to look at.
Rough. Real rough. Yeah. Honestly, you know, maybe just the waitress from the diner in the very beginning.
Wants her cigarettes
still
back.
Still wants her cigarettes back. she shows up and puts an end to the porter.
Or the one nostril to heroin deliverer.
Oh, God, who I think, yeah.
Who I think might have been... It looked like Freddy Rodriguez, but I don't think it was.
Yeah, he had that look to him.
Good. Yeah, I don't think it was, but he really looked like him.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't...
Maybe in Canada, Porter teams up with a world-weary African-American robber who's too old for this shit. Joe Pesci shows up. What if it's just a prequel to Lethal Weapon, Payback?
Oh.
Because in this, you see Porter has a United States Marine Corps tattoo on his arm.
Yeah, yeah.
And
a really fresh one, like a really hilariously obvious, like just like a temporary one.
Like
but
he,
yeah, it's
like
there.
He was like in the reserves or something. Yeah. And never actually saw combat.
Never even got a sunburn.
But then he was like, oh, I didn't get to do much with USMC. Maybe I'll join like Delta Force or whatever it is in Lethal Weapon.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Now the continuity, like timeline.
All Mel Gibson movies are part of the same universe.
Oh, God, it could almost work. Oh, no, now I've got a new fan theory rabbit hole to devote my life to. Move over, Avril Lavigne. I've got a new crush.
Mel Gibson consistently reincarnated through history.
Oh, man, they're all descended from his character in The Patriot. They're all cousins of William Wallace somehow. One of them fought in Gallipoli, or whatever that movie is about.
I have no idea.
He was in a movie called Gallipoli.
Oh, okay.
I think like he's part of like an Italian Navy fleet or something like during like the 1600s. I don't know. It looked like an old timey movie.
Okay.
Anthony Hopkins might be in it. Maybe. I don't know. Australia. There we go.
Okay.
So, Paul Hogan might be in it. Yahoo Serious might be in it.
Oh, boy.
Peter Jackson might have been around.
So this is what happens post-payback. The loop continues. Yep. The chain remains unbroken. Mel Gibson continually reincarnated throughout history in this miserable, never-ending Highlander-esque existence.
Oh, my God. Oh, maybe now he can come back as someone who can put a decent movie out. I think the last thing I saw him in was Edge of Darkness, which
Ooh.
Was okay, but that's about it.
Yeah.
So.
Yep.
Well, that's been the theatrical cut of Payback.
All right.
I guess let's wrap up with plugs. What do you got coming up?
On the 1st of August over at Ace of Cups, we got the next Columbus Stands Up for Choice. Me, Amber Falter, some Columbus comics. We've got... Mary Santora from Cleveland headlining.
Oh, she's great.
And Brooke Cardis featuring on that. So really looking forward to that show.
Awesome.
And just before that, two shows with you, the Pop Culture Mixtape Pop-Up Video Edition, which I'm super excited for.
Oh, that will have happened by the time this podcast
goes on. Whoops, never mind. but we do have the Roast of Spider-Man.
Yes. What was that? July 31st at Mike's.
July 31st, yeah. Yep.
Awesome. I guess for me, just check out whiskeybearcomedy.com. I also released an album called No, The World Needs Laughter. It's available on iTunes.
Download it. It's great.
Yeah. It's a fun time. Give me money, please. We got The Roast of Spider-Man. We also have coming up on Monday, July 24th, my everyone's favorite show but mine, a show called Hot Dog, yes. A comedy show / hot dog eating contest. Mikey's Late Night Slice at 8 o'clock, $5, where I make comedians eat hot dogs, and for some reason, everyone loves that son as opposed to my other son, the Pop Culture Mixtape, more. So come to all those shows, though.
Absolutely.
Cool, cool. All right, well, I think that's it. Eric, thank you for running sound and also researching and jumping in with the feedback. Thank you, Pat Deering, for coming on.
Absolutely.
And watching
anytime.
Payback. And we'll watch the director's cut sometime soon. Thank you all for listening, and we'll catch you next time. It's the Big Dumb Picture Show. It's fun hearing noises. And welcome back to Big Dumb Picture Show. As always, I am your